of my youth. And though it's cliche, the best medicine was talking about it with the people who understood. I asked Aunt Wee if she had similar relationship experiences, and she answered almost reflexively. "Of course. I was always ready for battle with Dan," she told me. "Sometimes I'd even brace myself for a big argument, like physically put myself in a fighting position before he stopped speaking." I was shocked. Aunt Wee and Dan have the most successful marriage I've seen. Even after 20 years, they interact like they started dating last year. Her marriage got even better, she said, only after she realized that she didn't have to be on guard all the time. Lindsay told me the same. "When I fought with Kevin, I'd insult him and tell him to do what I knew he wanted to do anyway, leave. He'd always ask me, 'What's wrong with you? Why do you fight with me like I'm your enemy?' The answer is that, in our home, it was often difficult to tell friend from foe. 16 years later, though, and Lindsay is still married. I thought a lot about myself, about the emotional triggers I'd learned over 18 years of living at home. I realized that I mistrusted apologies, as they were often used to convince you to lower your guard. It was an I'm sorry that convinced me to take that fateful car ride with Mom more than a decade earlier. And I began to understand why I used words as weapons. That's what everyone around me did. I did it to survive. Disagreements were war, and you played to win the game. I didn't unlearn these lessons overnight. I continue to struggle with conflict, to fight the statistical odds that sometimes seem to bear down on me. Sometimes it's easier knowing that the statistics suggest I should be in jail or fathering my fourth illegitimate child. And sometimes it's harder. Conflict and family breakdown seem like the destiny I can't possibly escape. In my worst moments, I convince myself that there is no exit, and no matter how much I fight old demons, they are as much an inheritance as my blue eyes and brown hair. The sad fact is that I couldn't do it without Usha. Even at my best, I'm a delayed explosion. I can be diffused, but only with skill and precision. It's not just that I've learned to control myself, but that Usha has learned how to manage me. Put two of me in the same home, and you have a positively radioactive situation. It's no surprise that every single person in my family who has built a successful home, Aunt Wee, Lindsay, my cousin Gail, married someone from outside our little culture. This realization shattered the narrative I told about my life. In my own head, I was better than my past. I was strong. I left town as soon as I could, served my country in the Marines, excelled at Ohio State, and made it to the country's top law school. I had no demons, no character flaws, no problems. But that just wasn't true. The thing I wanted most in the entire world, a happy partner and a happy home, required constant mental focus. My self-image was bitterness masquerading as arrogance. A few weeks into my second year of law school, I hadn't spoken to Mom in many months, longer than at any point in my life. I realized that of all the emotions I felt toward my mother, love, pity, forgiveness, anger, hatred, and dozens of others, I had never tried sympathy. I had never tried to understand my mom. At my most empathetic, I figured she suffered from some terrible genetic defect, and I hoped I hadn't inherited it. As I increasingly saw Mom's behavior in myself, I tried to understand her. Uncle Jimmy told me that, long ago, he'd walked in on a discussion between Mama and Papa. Mom had gotten herself in some trouble, and they needed to bail her out. These bailouts were common, and they always came with theoretical strings attached. She had to budget, they'd tell her, and they'd put her on some arbitrary plan they'd designed themselves. The plan was the cost of their help. As they sat and discussed things, Papaw buried his head in his hands and did something Uncle Jimmy had never seen him do. He wept. "I failed her," he cried. He kept on repeating, "I failed her. I failed her. I failed my baby girl." Papaw's rare breakdown strikes at the heart of an important question for hillbillies like me. How much of our lives, good and bad, should we credit to our personal decisions, and how much is just the inheritance of our culture, our families, and our parents who have failed their children? How much is Mom's life her own fault? Where does blame stop and sympathy begin? All of us have opinions. Uncle Jimmy reacts viscerally to the idea that any of the blame for Mom's choices can be laid at Papaw's feet. He didn't fail her. Whatever happened to her, it's her own damned fault. Aunt Wee sees things in much the same way, and who can blame her? Just 19 months younger than Mom, she saw the worst of Mamaw and Papaw and made her own share of mistakes before coming out on the other side. If she can do it, then so should Mom. Lindsay has a bit more sympathy and thinks that just as our lives left us with demons, Mom's life must have done the same to her. But at some point, Lindsay says, you have to stop making excuses and take responsibility. My own view is mixed. Whatever might be said about my mom's parents' roles in my life, their constant fighting and alcoholism must have taken its toll on her. Even when they were children, the fighting seemed to affect my aunt and mother differently. While Aunt Wee would plead with her parents to calm down or provoke her father in order to take the heat off her mother, Mom would hide or run away or collapse on the floor with her hands over her ears. She didn't handle it as well as her brother and sister. In some ways, Mom is the Vance child who lost the game of statistics. If anything, my family is probably lucky that only one of them lost that game. What I do know is that Mom is no villain. She loves Lindsay and me. She tried desperately to be a good mother. Sometimes she succeeded, sometimes she didn't. She tried to find happiness in love and work, but she listened too much to the wrong voice in her head. But Mom deserves much of the blame. No person's childhood gives him or her a perpetual moral get-out-of-jail-free card. Not Lindsay, not Aunt Wee, not me, and not Mom. Throughout my life, no one could inspire such intense emotions as my mom, not even Mamaw. When I was a kid, I loved her so much that when a kindergarten classmate made fun of her umbrella, I punched him in the face. When I watched her succumb again and again to addiction, I hated her and wished sometimes that she would take enough narcotics to rid me and Lindsay of her for good. When she lay sobbing in bed after another failed relationship, I felt a rage that could have driven me to kill. Toward the end of law school, Lindsay called to tell me Mom had taken to a new drug, heroin, and had decided to give rehab another try. I didn't know how many times Mom had been to rehab, how many nights she'd spent in the hospital barely conscious because of some drug. So I shouldn't have been surprised or all that bothered, but heroin just has a certain ring to it. It's like the Kentucky Derby of drugs. When I learned of Mom's newest substance of choice, I felt a cloud hanging over me for weeks. Maybe I had finally lost all hope for her. The emotion Mom inspired then was not hatred or love or rage, but fear. Fear for her safety. Fear for Lindsay having to deal yet again with Mom's problems while I lived hundreds of miles away. Fear most of all that I hadn't escaped a goddamned thing. Months away from graduating from Yale Law, I should have felt on top of the world. Instead, I found myself wondering the same thing I'd wondered for much of the past year, whether people like us can ever truly change. When Usha and I graduated, the crew that watched me walk across the stage numbered 18, including my cousins Denise and Gail, the daughters, respectively, of Mamaw's brothers David and Pet. Usha's parents and uncle, fantastic people, though considerably less rowdy than our crew, made the trip too. It was the first time that her family met mine, and we behaved, though Denise had some choice words for the modern art at the museum we visited. Mom's bout with addiction ended as they always did, in an uneasy truce. She didn't make the trip to see me graduate, but she wasn't using drugs at that moment, and that was all right with me. Just as Sonia Sotomayor spoke at our commencement and advised that it was okay to be unsure about what we wanted to do with ourselves. I think she was talking about our careers, but for me, it had a much broader meaning. I had learned much about law at Yale, but I'd also learned that this new world would always seem a bit foreign to me, and that being a hillbilly meant sometimes not knowing the difference between love and war. When we graduated, that's what I was most unsure about. Chapter 15. What I remember most is the fucking spiders. Really big ones, like tarantulas or something. I stood at a window of one of those sleazy roadside motels, separated from a woman who certainly hadn't majored in hospitality management, by a thick pane of glass. The light from her office illuminated a few spider webs suspended between the building and the makeshift sunblocker that seemed primed to collapse on top of me. On each web was at least one giant spider, and I thought that if I looked away from them for too long, one of those ghastly creatures would jump on my face and suck my blood. I'm not even afraid of spiders, but these things were big. I wasn't supposed to be here. I'd structured my entire life to avoid just these types of places. When I thought of leaving my hometown, of getting out, it was from this sort of place that I wanted to escape. It was past midnight. The streetlight revealed the silhouette of a man sitting halfway in his truck, the door open, his feet dangling to the side, with the unmistakable form of a hypodermic needle sticking from his arm. I should have been shocked, but this was Middletown after all. Just a few weeks earlier, the police had discovered a woman passed out at the local car wash, a bag of heroin and a spoon in the passenger seat, the needle still protruding from her arm. The woman running the hotel that night was the most pitiful sight of all. She might have been 40, but everything about her, from the long, gray, greasy hair, the mouth empty of teeth, and the frown that she wore like a millstone, screamed old age. This woman had lived a hard life. Her voice sounded like a small child's, even a toddler's. It was meek, barely audible, and very sad. I gave the woman my credit card, and she was clearly unprepared. Normally, people pay cash, she explained. I told her, yeah, but like I said on the phone, I'm going to pay with a credit card. I can run to an ATM if you'd prefer. Oh, I'm sorry, I guess I forgot. But it's okay, we've got one of those machines around here somewhere. So she retrieved one of those ancient card-swiping machines, the kind that imprints the card's information on a yellow slip of paper. When I handed her the card, her eyes seemed to plead with me, as if she were a prisoner in her own life. "Enjoy your stay," she said, which struck me as an odd instruction. I had told her on the phone not an hour earlier that the room wasn't for me, it was for my homeless mother. "Okay," I said. "Thanks." I was a recent graduate of Yale Law School, a former editor of the prestigious Yale Law Journal, and a member of the bar in good standing. Just 2 months earlier, Usha and I were married on a beautiful day in eastern Kentucky. My entire family showed up for the occasion, and we both changed our name to Vance, giving me, finally, the same name as the family to which I belonged. I had a nice job, a recently purchased home, a loving relationship, and a happy life in a city I loved, Cincinnati. Usha and I had returned there for a year after law school for one-year clerkships and had built a home with our two dogs. I was upwardly mobile. I had made it. I had achieved the American dream. Or at least that's how it looked to an outsider. But upward mobility is never clean cut, and the world I left always finds a way to reel me back in. I don't know the precise chain of events that led me to that hotel, but I knew the stuff that mattered. Mom had begun using again. She'd stolen some family heirlooms from her fifth husband to buy drugs, prescription opiates, I think, and he'd kicked her out of the house in response. They were divorcing, and she had nowhere to go. I'd sworn to myself that I'd never help Mom again, but the person who made that oath to himself had changed. I was exploring, however uneasily, the Christian faith that I'd discarded years earlier. I had learned, for the first time, the extent of Mom's childhood emotional wounds. And I had realized that those wounds never truly heal, even for me. So when I discovered that Mom was in dire straits, I didn't mutter insults under my breath and hang up the phone. I offered to help her. I tried to call a Middletown hotel and give them my credit card information. The cost for a week was $150, and I figured that would give us time to come up with a plan. But they wouldn't accept my card over the phone. So at 11 p.m. on a Tuesday night, I drove from Cincinnati to Middletown, about an hour's drive each way, to keep Mom from homelessness. The plan I developed seemed relatively simple. I'd give Mom enough money to help her get on her feet. She'd find her own place, save money to get her nursing license back, and go from there. In the meantime, I'd monitor her finances to ensure that she stayed clean and on track financially. It reminded me of the plans Mama and Papa used to put together, but I convinced myself that this time things would be different. I'd like to say that helping Mom came easily, that I had made some peace with my past and was able to fix a problem that had plagued me since elementary school. That, armed with sympathy and an understanding of Mom's childhood, I was able to patiently help Mom deal with her addiction. But dealing with that sleazy motel was hard, and actively managing her finances, as I planned to do, required more patience and time than I had. By the grace of God, I no longer hide from Mom, but I can't fix everything either. There is room now for both anger at Mom for the life she chooses and sympathy for the childhood she didn't. There is room to help when I can, when finances and emotional reserves allow me to care in the way Mom needs, but there is also recognition of my own limitations and my willingness to separate myself from Mom when engagement means too little money to pay my own bills or too little patience left over for the people who matter most. That's the uneasy truce I've struck with myself, and it works for now. People sometimes ask whether I think there's anything we can do to solve the problems of my community. I know what they're looking for: a magical public policy solution or an innovative government program. But these problems of family, faith, and culture aren't like a Rubik's Cube, and I don't think that solutions, as most understand the term, really exist. A good friend, who worked for a time in the White House and cares deeply about the plight of the working class, once told me, "The best way to look at this might be to recognize that you probably can't fix these things. They'll always be around. But maybe you can put your thumb on the scale a little for the people at the margins." There were many thumbs put on my scale. When I look back at my life, what jumps out is how many variables had to fall in place in order to give me a chance. There was my grandparents' constant presence, even when my mother and stepfather moved far away in an effort to shut them out. Despite the revolving door of would-be father figures, I was often surrounded by caring and kind men. Even with her faults, Mom instilled in me a lifelong love of education and learning. My sister always protected me, even after I'd physically outgrown her. Dan and Aunt Wee opened their home when I was too afraid to ask. Long before that, they were my first real exemplars of a happy and loving marriage. There were teachers, distant relatives, and friends. Remove any of these people from the equation, and I'm probably screwed. Other people who have overcome the odds cite the same sorts of interventions. Jane Rex runs the transfer students office at Appalachian State University. Like me, she grew up in a working-class family and was its first member to attend college. She's also been married for nearly 40 years and has raised 3 successful kids of her own. Ask what made a difference in her life, and she'll tell you about the stable family that empowered her and gave her a sense of control over her future. And she'll tell you about the power of seeing enough of the world to dream big. I think you have to have good role models around you. One of my very good friends, her father was the president of the bank, so I got to see different things. I knew there was another life out there, and that exposure gives you something to dream for. My cousin Gail is one of my all-time favorite people. She's one of the first of my mom's generation, the Blanton grandchildren. Gail's life is the American dream personified: a beautiful house, 3 great kids, a happy marriage, and a saintly demeanor. Outside of Mamaw Blanton, a virtual deity in the eyes of us grandkids and great-grandkids, I've never heard anyone else called the nicest person in the world. For Gail, it's an entirely deserved title. I assumed that Gail had inherited her storybook life from her parents. No one's that nice, I thought, especially not someone who suffered any real adversity. But Gail was a Blanton, and at heart, a hillbilly, and I should have known that no hillbilly makes it to adulthood without a few major screw-ups along the way. Gail's home life provided its own emotional baggage. She was 7 when her dad walked out, and 17 when she graduated from high school, planning for college at Miami University. But there was a catch. Mom told me I couldn't go to college unless I broke up with my boyfriend. So I moved out the day after graduation, and by August, I was pregnant. Almost immediately, her life began to disintegrate. Racial prejudice bubbled to the surface when she announced that a black baby was joining the family. Announcements led to arguments, And then one day Gail found herself without a family. I didn't hear from any of our relatives, Gail told me. My mom said she never wanted to hear my name again. Given her age and the lack of family support, it's hardly surprising that her marriage soon ended. But Gail's life had grown considerably more complex. She hadn't just lost her family, she'd gained a young daughter who depended entirely on her. It completely changed my life. Being a mom was my identity. I might have been a hippie, but now I had rules. No drugs, no alcohol, nothing that was going to lead to social services taking my baby away. So here's Gail, teenage single mom, no family, little support. A lot of people would wilt in those circumstances, but the hillbilly took over. Dad wasn't really around, Gail remembered, and hadn't been in years, and I obviously wasn't speaking to Mom. But I remember the one lesson I took from them, and that was that we could do anything we wanted. I wanted that baby, and I wanted to make it work, so I did it. She got a job with a local telephone company, worked her way up the ladder, and even returned to college. By the time she remarried, she had hit one hell of a stride. The storybook marriage to her second husband, Alan, is just icing on the cake. Some version of Gail's story often rears its head where I grew up. You watch as teenagers find themselves in dire straits, sometimes of their own making and sometimes not. The statistics are stacked high against them, and many succumb to crime or an early death at worst, domestic strife and welfare dependency at best. But others make it. There's Jane Rex. There's Lindsay, who blossomed in the midst of Mamaw's death. Aunt Wee, who put her life on track after ditching an abusive husband. Each benefited from the same types of experiences in one way or another. They had a family member they could count on, and they saw, from a family friend, an uncle, or a work mentor, what was available and what was possible. Not long after I began thinking about what might help the American working class get ahead, a team of economists, including Raj Chetty, published a groundbreaking study on opportunity in America. Unsurprisingly, they found that a poor kid's chances of rising through the ranks of America's meritocracy were lower than most of us wanted. By their metrics, a lot of European countries seem better than America at the American dream. More important, they discovered that opportunity was not spread evenly over the whole country. In places like Utah, Oklahoma, and Massachusetts, the American dream was doing just fine, as good or better than any other place in the world. It was in the South, the Rust Belt, and Appalachia where poor kids really struggled. Their findings surprised a lot of people, but not me, and not anyone who'd spent any time in these areas. In a paper analyzing the data, Chetty and his co-authors noted two important factors that explained the uneven geographic distribution of opportunity: the prevalence of single parents and income segregation. Growing up around a lot of single moms and dads, and living in a place where most of your neighbors are poor really narrows the realm of possibilities. It means that unless you have a mamaw and papaw to make sure you stay the course, you might never make it out. It means that you don't have people to show you by example what happens when you work hard and get an education. It means, essentially, that everything that made it possible for me, Lindsay, Gail, Jane Rex, and Aunt Wee to find some measure of happiness is missing. So I wasn't surprised that Mormon Utah, with its strong church, integrated communities, and intact families, wiped the floor with Rust Belt Ohio. There are, I think, policy lessons to draw from my life, ways we might put our thumb on that all-important scale. We can adjust how our social service systems treat families like mine. Remember that when I was 12, I watched Mom get hauled away in a police cruiser. I'd seen her get arrested before, but I knew that this time was different. We were in the system now, with social worker visits and mandated family counseling, and a court date hanging over my head like a guillotine blade. Ostensibly, the caseworkers were there to protect me. But it became very obvious very early in the process that they were obstacles to overcome. When I explained that I spent most of my time with my grandparents and that I'd like to continue with that arrangement, they replied that the courts would not necessarily sanction such an arrangement. In the eyes of the law, my grandmother was an untrained caretaker without a foster license. If things went poorly for my mother in the courts, I was as likely to find myself with a foster family as I was with Mamaw. The notion of being separated from everyone and everything I loved was terrifying. So I shut my mouth, told the social workers everything was fine, and hoped that I wouldn't lose my family when the court hearing came. That hope panned out. Mom didn't go to jail, and I got to stay with Mamaw. The arrangement was informal. I could stay with Mom if I wanted, but if not, Mamaw's door was always open. The enforcement mechanism was equally informal. Mamaw would kill anyone who tried to keep me from her. This worked for us because Mamaw was a lunatic and our entire family feared her. Not everyone can rely on the saving graces of a crazy hillbilly. Child services are, for many kids, the last pieces of the safety net. If they fall through, precious little remains to catch them. Part of the problem is how state laws define the family. For families like mine, and for many Black and Hispanic families, grandparents, cousins, aunts, and uncles play an outsized role. Child services often cut them out of the picture, as they did in my case. Some states require occupational licensing for foster parents, just like nurses and doctors, even when the would-be foster parent is a grandmother or another close family member. In other words, our country's social services weren't made for hillbilly families, and they often make a bad problem worse. I wish I could say this was a small problem, but it's not. In a given year, 640,000 children, most of them poor, will spend at least some time in foster care. Add that to the unknown number of kids who face abuse or neglect but somehow avoid the foster care system, and you have an epidemic, one that current policies exacerbate. There are other things we can do. We can build policies based on a better understanding of what stands in the way of kids like me. The most important lesson of my life is not that society failed to provide me with opportunities. My elementary and middle schools were entirely adequate, staffed with teachers who did everything they could to reach me. Our high school ranked near the bottom of Ohio's schools, but that had little to do with the staff and much to do with the students. I had Pell Grants and government-subsidized low-interest student loans that made college affordable, and need-based scholarships for law school. I never went hungry, thanks at least in part to the old-age benefits that Mamaw generously shared with me. These programs are far from perfect, but to the degree that I nearly succumbed to my worst decisions, and I came quite close, the fault lies almost entirely with factors outside the government's control. Recently, I sat down with a group of teachers from my alma mater, Middletown High. All of them expressed the worry, in one form or another, that society devoted too many resources too late in the game. "It's like our politicians think college is the only way," one teacher told me. "For many, it's great, but a lot of our kids have no realistic shot of getting a college degree." Another said, "The violence and the fighting, it's all they've seen from a very young age. One of my students lost her baby like she'd lost her car keys, had no idea where it went. 2 weeks later, her child turned up in New York City with the father, a drug dealer, and some of his family. Short of a miracle, we all know what kind of life awaits that poor baby. Yet there's precious little to support her now, when an intervention might help." So I think that any successful policy program would recognize what my old high school's teachers see every day. That the real problem for so many of these kids is what happens or doesn't at home. For example, we'd recognize that Section 8 vouchers ought to be administered in a way that doesn't segregate the poor into little enclaves. As Brian Campbell, another Middletown teacher, told me, "When you have a large base of Section 8 parents and kids supported by fewer middle-class taxpayers, it's an upside-down triangle. There's fewer emotional and financial resources when the only people in a neighborhood are low-income. You just can't lump them together because then you have a bigger pool of hopelessness." On the other hand, he said, "Put the lower-income kids with those who have a different lifestyle model, and the lower-income kids start to rise up." Yet when Middletown recently tried to limit the number of Section 8 vouchers offered within certain neighborhoods, the federal government balked. Better, I suppose, to keep those kids cut off from the middle class. Government policy may be powerless to resolve other problems in our community. As a child, I associated accomplishments in school with femininity. Manliness meant strength, courage, a willingness to fight, and later, success with girls. Boys who got good grades were sissies or faggots. I don't know where I got this feeling. certainly not from Mamaw, who demanded good grades, nor from Papaw. But it was there, and studies now show that working-class boys like me do much worse in school because they view schoolwork as a feminine endeavor. Can you change this with a new law or program? Probably not. Some scales aren't that amenable to the proverbial thumb. I've learned that the very traits that enabled my survival during childhood inhibit my success as an adult. I see conflict and I run away or prepare for battle. This makes little sense in my current relationships, but without that attitude, my childhood homes would have consumed me. I learned early to spread my money out, lest mom or someone else find it and borrow it, some under the mattress, some in the underwear drawer, some at Mamaw's house. When, later in life, Usha and I consolidated finances, she was shocked to learn that I had multiple bank accounts and small past due balances on credit cards. Usha still sometimes reminds me that not every perceived slight from a passing motorist or a neighbor critical of my dogs is cause for a blood feud, and I always concede, despite my raw emotions, that she's probably right. A couple of years ago, I was driving in Cincinnati with Usha when somebody cut me off. I honked, the guy flipped me off, and when we stopped at a red light with this guy in front of me, I unbuckled my seatbelt and opened the car door. I planned to demand an apology and fight the guy if necessary, but my common sense prevailed and I shut the door before I got out of the car. Usha was delighted that I changed my mind before she yelled at me to stop acting like a lunatic, which has happened in the past, and she told me that she was proud of me for resisting my natural instinct. The other driver's sin was to insult my honor, and it was on that honor that nearly every element of my happiness depended as a child. It kept the school bully from messing with me, connected me to my mother when some man or his children insulted her, even if I agreed with the substance of the insult, and gave me something, however small, over which I exercised complete control. For the first 18 or so years of my life, standing down would have earned me a verbal lashing as a pussy or a wimp or a girl. The objectively correct course of action was something that the majority of my life had taught me was repulsive to an upstanding young man. For a few hours after I did the right thing, I silently criticized myself. But that's progress, right? Better that than sitting in a jail cell for teaching that asshole a lesson about defensive driving. Conclusion. Shortly before Christmas last year, I stood in the kids section of a Washington, D.C. Walmart, shopping list in hand, gazing at toys and talking myself out of each of them. That year, I had volunteered to adopt a needy child, which meant that I was given a list by the local branch of the Salvation Army and told to return with a bag of unwrapped Christmas gifts. It sounded pretty simple, but I managed to find fault with nearly every suggestion. Pajamas? Poor people don't wear pajamas. We fall asleep in our underwear or blue jeans. To this day, I find the very notion of pajamas an unnecessary elite indulgence, like caviar or electric ice cube makers. There was a toy guitar that I thought looked both fun and enriching, but I remembered the electronic keyboard my grandparents had given me one year, and how one of Mom's boyfriends meanly ordered me to shut that fucking thing up. I passed on learning aids for fear of appearing condescending. Eventually, I settled on some clothes, a fake cell phone, and fire trucks. I grew up in a world where everyone worried about how they'd pay for Christmas. Now I live in one where opportunities abound for the wealthy and privileged to shower their generosity on the community's poor. Many prestigious law firms sponsor an angel program, which assigns a child to a lawyer and provides a wish list of gifts. Usha's former courthouse encouraged judicial employees to adopt a kid for the holidays, each a child of someone who previously went through the court system. Program coordinators hoped that if someone else purchased presents, the child's parents might feel less tempted to commit crimes in order to provide. And there's always Toys for Tots. During the past few Christmas seasons, I found myself in large department stores buying toys for kids I've never met. As I shop, I'm reminded that wherever I fell on the American socioeconomic ladder as a child, others occupy much lower rungs. Children who cannot depend on the generosity of grandparents for Christmas gifts. Parents whose financial situations are so dire that they rely on criminal conduct rather than payday loans to put today's hot toys under the tree. This is a very useful exercise. As scarcity has given way to plenty in my own life, these moments of retail reflection force me to consider just how lucky I am. Still, shopping for low-income kids reminds me of my childhood and of the ways that Christmas gifts can serve as domestic landmines. Every year, the parents in my neighborhood would begin an annual ritual very different from the one I've become accustomed to in my new material comfort, worrying about how to give their kids a nice Christmas, with niceness always defined by the bounty underneath the Christmas tree. If your friends came over the week before Christmas and saw a barren floor beneath the tree, you would offer a justification. Mom just hasn't gone shopping yet, or Dad's waiting for a big paycheck at the end of the year, and then he'll get a ton of stuff. These excuses were meant to mask what everyone knew. All of us were poor, and no amount of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle memorabilia would change that. No matter our financial position, our family somehow managed to spend just more than we had on holiday shopping. We didn't qualify for credit cards, but there were many ways to spend money you didn't have. You could write a future date on a check, a practice called post-dating, so the recipient couldn't cash it until you had money in the bank. You could draw a short-term loan from a payday lender. If all else failed, you could borrow money from the grandparents. Indeed, I recall many winter conversations in which Mom pleaded with Mamaw and Papaw to lend her money to ensure that their grandchildren had a nice Christmas. They'd always protest Mom's understanding of what made Christmas nice, but they'd still give in. It might be the day before Christmas, but our tree would be piled high with the trendiest gifts, even as our family savings dwindled from very little to nothing, then from nothing to something less than that. When I was a baby, Mom and Lindsay frantically searched for a Teddy Ruxpin doll, a toy so popular that every store in town sold out. It was expensive and, as I was only two, unnecessary. But Lindsay still remembers the day wasted searching for the toy. Mom somehow received a tip about a stranger who was willing to part with one of his Ruxpins at a significant markup. Mom and Lindsay traveled to his house to fetch the trinket that stood between a child who could barely walk and the Christmas of his dreams. The only thing I remember of old Teddy Ruxpin is finding him in a box years later, his sweater tattered and his face covered in crusted snot. It was the holiday season that taught me about tax refunds, which I gathered were free bits of money sent to the poor in the new year to save them from the financial indiscretions of the old one. Income tax refunds were the ultimate backstops. "We can definitely afford this. We'll just pay for it with a refund check," became a Christmas mantra. But the government was fickle. There were few moments more anxious than the one when Mom came home from the tax preparer in early January. Sometimes the refund exceeded expectations, but when Mom learned that Uncle Sam couldn't cover the Christmas splurge because her credits weren't as high as she had hoped, that could ruin your whole month. Ohio Januaries are depressing enough as it is. I assume that rich people celebrated Christmas just like us, perhaps with fewer financial worries and even cooler presents. Yet I noticed after my cousin Bonnie was born that Christmas time at Aunt Wee's house had a decidedly different flavor. Somehow my aunt and uncle's children ended up with more pedestrian gifts than I had come to expect as a child. There was no obsession with meeting a $200 or $300 threshold for each child. No worry that a kid would suffer in the absence of the newest electronic gadget. Usha often received books for Christmas. My cousin Bonnie, at the age of 11, asked her parents to donate her Christmas gifts to Middletown's needy. Shockingly, her parents obliged. They didn't define their family's Christmas holiday by the dollar value of the gifts their daughter accumulated. However you want to define these two groups and their approach to giving, rich and poor, educated and uneducated, upper class and working class, their members increasingly occupy two separate worlds. As a cultural immigrant from one group to the other, I am acutely aware of their differences. Sometimes I view members of the elite with an almost primal scorn. Recently, an acquaintance used the word confabulate in a sentence, and I just wanted to scream. But I have to give it to them. Their children are happier and healthier, their divorce rates lower, their church attendance higher, their lives longer. These people are beating us at our own damned game. I was able to escape the worst of my culture's inheritance. And uneasy though I am about my new life, I cannot whine about it. The life I lead now was the stuff of fantasy during my childhood. So many people helped create that fantasy. At every level of my life and in every environment, I have found family and mentors and lifelong friends who supported and enabled me. But I often wonder, where would I be without them? I think back on my freshman year of high school, a grade I nearly failed, and the morning when Mom walked into Mamaw's house demanding a cup of clean urine. Or years before that, when I was a lonely kid with two fathers, neither of whom I saw very often, and Papaw decided that he would be the best dad he could be for as long as he lived. or the months I spent with Lindsay, a teenage girl acting as a mother while our own mother lived in a treatment center, or the moment I can't remember when Papaw installed a secret phone line in the bottom of my toy box so that Lindsay could call Mamaw and Papaw if things got a little too crazy. Thinking about it now, about how close I was to the abyss, gives me chills. I am one lucky son of a bitch. Not long ago, I had lunch with Brian, a young man who reminded me of 15-year-old JD. Like Mom, his mother caught a taste for narcotics, and like me, he has a complicated relationship with his father. He's a sweet kid with a big heart and a quiet manner. He has spent nearly his entire life in Appalachian, Kentucky. We went to lunch at a local fast food restaurant because in that corner of the world there isn't much else to eat. As we talked, I noticed little quirks that few others would. He didn't want to share his milkshake, which was a little out of character for a kid who ended every sentence with please or thank you. He finished his food quickly and then nervously looked from person to person. I could tell that he wanted to ask a question, so I wrapped my arm around his shoulder and asked if he needed anything. Yeah, he started, refusing to make eye contact. And then, almost in a whisper, I wonder if I could get a few more French fries. He was hungry. In 2014, in the richest country on earth, he wanted a little extra to eat, but felt uncomfortable asking. Lord help us. Just a few months after we saw each other last, Brian's mom died unexpectedly. He hadn't lived with her in years, so outsiders might imagine that her death was easier to bear. Those folks are wrong. People like Brian and me don't lose contact with our parents because we don't care. We lose contact with them to survive. We never stop loving, and we never lose hope that our loved ones will change. Rather, we are forced, either by wisdom or by the law, to take the path of self-preservation. What happens to Brian? He has no Mamaw or Papaw, at least not like mine, and though he's lucky enough to have supportive family who will keep him out of foster care, his hope of a normal life evaporated long ago, if it ever existed. When we met, his mother had already permanently lost custody. In his short life, he has already experienced multiple instances of childhood trauma, and in a few years he will begin making decisions about employment and education that even children of wealth and privilege have trouble navigating. Any chance he has lies with the people around him. His family, me, my kin, the people like us, and the broad community of hillbillies. And if that chance is to materialize, we hillbillies must wake the hell up. Brian's mom's death was another shitty card in an already abysmal hand, but there are many cards left to deal. Whether his community empowers him with a sense that he can control his own destiny, or encourages him to take refuge in resentment at forces beyond his control. Whether he can access a church that teaches him lessons of Christian love, family, and purpose. Whether those people who do step up to positively influence Brian find emotional and spiritual support from their neighbors. I believe we hillbillies are the toughest goddamn people on this earth. We take an electric saw to the hide of those who insult our mother. We make young men consume cotton undergarments to protect a sister's honor. But are we tough enough to do what needs to be done to help a kid like Brian? Are we tough enough to build a church that forces kids like me to engage with the world rather than withdraw from it? Are we tough enough to look ourselves in the mirror and admit that our conduct harms our children? Public policy can help, but there is no government that can fix these problems for us. Recall how my cousin Mike sold his mother's house, a property that had been in our family for over a century, because he couldn't trust his own neighbors not to ransack it. Mamaw refused to purchase bicycles for her grandchildren because they kept disappearing, even when locked up, from her front porch. She feared answering her door toward the end of her life because an able-bodied woman who lived next door would not stop bothering her for cash. Money, we later learned, for drugs. These problems were not created by governments or corporations or anyone else. We created them, and only we can fix them. We don't need to live like the elites of California, New York, or Washington, D.C. We don't need to work 100 hours a week at law firms and investment banks. We don't need to socialize at cocktail parties. We do need to create a space for the JDs and Bryans of the world to have a chance. I don't know what the answer is precisely, but I know that it starts when we stop blaming Obama or Bush or faceless companies and ask ourselves what we can do to make things better. I wanted to ask Brian whether, like me, he had bad dreams. For nearly 2 decades, I suffered from a terrible recurring nightmare. The first time it came to me, I was 7, fast asleep in my great Mamaw Blanton's bed. In the dream, I'm trapped in a large conference room in a large treehouse, as if the Keebler elves had just finished a massive picnic and their treehouse were still adorned with dozens of tables and chairs. I'm there alone with Lindsay and Mamaw, when all of a sudden Mom charges through the room, tossing tables and chairs as she goes. She screams, but her voice is robotic and distorted, as if filtered through radio static. Mamaw and Lindsay run for a hole in the floor, presumably the exit ladder from the treehouse. I fall behind, and by the time I reach the exit, Mom is just behind me. I wake up, right as she's about to grab me, when I realize not just that the monster has caught me, but that Mamaw and Lindsay have abandoned me. In different versions, the antagonist changes form. It has been a Marine Corps drill instructor, a barking dog, a movie villain, and a mean teacher. Mamaw and Lindsay always make an appearance, and they always make it to the exit just ahead of me. Without fail, the dream provokes pure terror. The first time I had it, I woke up and ran to Mamaw, who was up late watching TV. I explained the dream and begged her never to leave me. She promised that she wouldn't and stroked my hair until I fell asleep again. My subconscious had spared me for years, when, out of nowhere, I had the dream again a few weeks after I graduated from law school. There was a crucial difference. The subject of the monster's ire wasn't me, but my dog, Casper, with whom I'd lost my temper earlier in the night. There was no Lindsay and no Mamaw, and I was the monster. I chased my poor dog around the treehouse, hoping to catch him and throttle him. But I felt Casper's terror, and I felt my shame at having lost my temper. I finally caught up to him, but I didn't wake up. Instead, Casper turned and looked at me with those sad, heart-piercing eyes that only dogs possess. So I didn't throttle him. I gave him a hug. And the last emotion I felt before waking was relief at having controlled my temper. I got out of bed for a glass of cold water, and when I returned, Casper was staring at me, wondering what on earth his human was doing awake at such an odd hour. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, probably about the same time it was when I first woke from the terrifying dream over 20 years earlier. There was no Mamaw to comfort me, but there were my 2 dogs on the floor, and there was the love of my life lying in bed. Tomorrow, I would go to work, take the dogs to the park,